Welcome to North Star, where we lead people to follow Jesus Christ and not simply go to church, but be the church. You can learn more about North Star by clicking on our website, northstarfamily.org. Thanks again, and we look forward to seeing you next time at North Star Church.
Holy Spirit.
Good morning. Earlier, we said my name is Daryl, and we're giving our pastor the Sunday off. He got us through Palm Sunday and Easter, so we're letting him rest his voice this morning. And we have been walking through the book of Acts together for a good time now. And today, we're going to dive right in with Acts chapter 23. We will be looking at the plot against Paul's life, his audience before Felix, and we'll see some people we've already met. We'll see the Tribune, who is a guy who is skittish and reactionary and dramatic and worrisome and excessive. We will see the high priest, and Jeff had told us how off-base this guy was, and we see his intensity and that he probably needs to go off caffeine because he also is very reactionary. And obviously we'll get a lot about Paul too. He's the one in chains. He is the one that cannot control where he goes next, and these guys seem to have the control over what he does next. But he's the one who's calm, where they're the ones who are worked up in all these situations. So let's dive right in, 23 of the book of Acts, and we'll look at verses 12 through 15 to start. And I call this section the 40-plus hangry men. So here we go. Verse 12 says, "When it was day, the Jews made a plot and bound themselves by an oath neither to eat nor drink till they killed Paul. There were more than 40 who made this conspiracy. They went to the chief priests and elders and said, 'We have strictly bound ourselves by an oath to taste no food till we have killed Paul. Now therefore you, along with the council, give notice to the tribune to bring him down to you, as though you were going to determine his case more exactly. And we are ready to kill him before he comes near.'" All right? And obviously I call it the 40-plus hangry men because, again, these angry guys are about to say, "We're not going to eat for a while," making them even more hangry. And their plot is to say, okay, what we're going to do is we're not eating or drinking until Paul dies and dies by our hand. And even they're deceptive about it. It says they'll give notes to the tribune to bring him down to you as though you were going to determine his case. Like they don't want anything close to justice. They want to eliminate Paul. And you might envision these guys around some of their friends visiting, and some guys are talking. They're like, "Hey, man, Ben's lost some weight. He looks good. Yeah. Paleo. Okay. Yeah. What about Zedekiah? Well, Whole 30. And how about you? You're looking good. Well, I'm on the don't eat anything until Paul dies diet. I'm pretty committed here." And you could take this passage and make an amazing kind of boom, boom, boom of like how to really be behind your decisions. I mean, these guys got accountability. They had religious zeal behind it. They went to the other religious leaders and said, "This is what we're doing." They put some definitive commitment behind it, because, you know, they're definitely committed. If this doesn't happen, they're not eating, and if they're not eating, they're dying. So you could make this a thing for, here's a great way to get behind something 100%. Unfortunately, they were doing the exact opposite of everything the Holy Spirit was about, though they felt like they were doing what they were doing for religious meanings and purposes, all right? So the next few verses is 16 through 18. Excuse me, I think I might sneeze. All right, we won't. Okay, verse 16 through 18, and I call this section, "Paul Has Family Members," because here is Paul who wrote this significant portion of the New Testament, and we know what he believes, we know what he has walked through, we know his testimony of how he's come to the Lord, but one of the neat things about Paul is we don't know a lot about his family and other things. He was so committed to, like, Christ and him crucified, that's what Paul communicated. Paul's not around, in Scripture telling stories about his family and all these other things. So to find out that he has a sister and has that sister has a son who is Paul's nephew, it's one of those rare moments. You're like, okay, yeah, Paul has family connections going on here, right? All right. So verses 16 through 18 says this. "Now the son of Paul's sister," hence nephew, right? All right. "Heard of their ambush. So he went and entered the barracks and told Paul. Paul called one of the centurions and said, 'Take this young man to the tribune, for he has something to tell him.' So he took him and brought him to the tribune and said, 'Paul, the prisoner, called me and asked me to bring this young man to you as he has something to say to you.' All right? So we see here that, again, this nephew comes into play as part of the communication about this plot that is a deceptive plot of these guys, that is not just to say we want justice, we want to ambush him, and we want to use the tribune to get what we want. Okay, so the next section, 23 verses 19 through 22, I call this section the tribune being the tribune, all right? He is going to do what the tribune does. He is going to show you his anxiety. He is going to show you his, again, reactionary kind of mentality. And just to get an appreciation for the consistency of who this guy is, I want us to look back at some of our other passages where the tribune was first introduced and to see this pattern that he brings to the table. Because everybody knows someone like this tribune. Everybody knows someone that is excessively worrisome, all right? You might go, yeah, that's my mom, or somebody like, no, that's my wife, or somebody like, no, that's my husband, that's my roommate, or whatever. You know someone that worries about everything and tries to take nth degree control, and their anxiety is worn on their sleeve. I have that as well. I have this friend, we'll call him Daryl, who has a problem with worry. And one example, right? Okay, if my phone rings, quite often, if I pull it out and see a name, when I see that name, I think about what is the worst thing that this person could be calling about. That's a horrible habit. Like my friend Dietrich is here. Dietrich and I work together at BCM, and we both are in charge of some things with the ministry center there, and Dietrich lives right behind it. So if Dietrich calls me at night, I'm going to be going, oh, man, the pipes burst. Oh. Or one of our students broke, so Peyton broke something in the building. And that's my first, and that's a horrible habit, and I apologize, and I confess in front of you, I'm a horrible sinner who worries too much, right? And none of you do that, right? But I do this sometimes, and I think this was part of the way that this tribune operated. And if you just see it again and again and again for him, of this worst-case scenario or fearful approach, going back to chapter 21, verses 30 through 33, and those verses say this. And this is the part where we get to all the movement of what we've been walking through. If Paul finally is arrested here, and then his imprisonment will just carry on for a while. So this is the moment where it happened and where he first meets the tribune, okay? These Jewish leaders are really upset with Paul. It says, then all the city was stirred up, and the people ran together. They seized Paul and dragged him out of the temple, and at once the gates were shut. And as they were seeking to kill him, word came to the tribune of the cohort that all Jerusalem was in confusion. He at once took his soldiers and centurions and ran down to them. And when they saw the tribune and the soldiers, they stopped beating Paul. That's good. Then the tribune came up and arrested him, that is Paul, and ordered him to be bound with two chains. All right, so again, this guy's pretty reactionary. Okay, you jump in. Okay, there's a big commotion. I come with my soldiers. This guy's being beat up. Okay. Let's arrest this guy, right? The guy who's beaten up, they arrest him. And Paul, they put, not just one, they put two chains on him. So again, everything this guy does is worrisome, excessive, trying to just squash things that don't even need to be squashed. Then later on in the same chapter, his first conversation with Paul, 21 verses 37 and 38. As Paul was about to be brought into the barracks, Paul says to the tribune, may I say something to you? And so then here's this point where the tribune hears Paul's voice for the first time and says, hey, he says, hey, oh, you know Greek, because Paul's speaking to him in Greek. Do you know Greek? Are you not the Egyptian then who recently stirred up a revolt and led 4,000 men of the assassins out into the wilderness? Now, scholars don't really have a great sense of who the 4,000 men of the assassins are, but I really don't want to mess with them. If assassins is in your name, I probably don't want to be part of that. But this is pretty intense that he just hears, oh, you know Greek? I bet you you're one of these guys with these 4,000 men of the assassin. He just immediately jumps to this craziness of the worst case scenario. And again, his fear of what Paul might do. And then Paul just goes on, no, actually, I'm just from Tarsus and goes on to give that background. But it's crazy how this guy immediately goes, oh, you must be part of this 4,000 men of the assassin. I think you might be the guy that was leading that stuff. So that's the second thing. Then these other two, then the next two references are both things just are full of fear. Chapter 22, verses 27 through 29, next time that he's mentioned. It says, so the tribune came and said to him, saying to Paul, that is, tell me, are you a Roman citizen? And Paul said, yes. The tribune answered, I bought this citizenship for a large sum. And Paul said, but I'm a citizen by birth. So those who were about to examine him withdrew from him immediately. And the tribune also was afraid, for he realized that Paul was a Roman citizen and that he had bound him. So again, slapping the two chains on him, and all this reaction, all this sudden you realize, oh my goodness, I need to treat him at a higher level because he's a Roman citizen. So his immediate reaction is just fear. Again, that's what we keep getting from the tribune. Chapter 23, verse 10 says, and when the dissension became violent, the tribune, afraid that Paul would be torn to pieces by them, this is when he's meeting with the Jews and speaking for the Jews, the tribune commanded the soldiers to go down and take him away from among them by force and bring him into the barracks. So again, every time you see him, it's excessive action, it's fear, and that doesn't stop there. Our next part, again, 23, back to our main part of the passage, 23, 19 through 22 says this. The tribune took him by the hand, took, again, this is Paul's nephew, and going aside, asked him privately, what is it you have to tell me? And he said, the Jews have agreed to ask you to bring Paul down to the council tomorrow, as though they were going to inquire somewhat more closely about him. But do not be persuaded by them, for more than 40 of their men are lying in ambush for him, who have bound themselves by an oath, neither to eat nor drink till they have killed them. And now they are ready, waiting for your consent. So the tribune dismissed the young man, charged him, tell no one that you've informed me of these things. So again, everything's dramatic, cloak and dagger. But then here's what he does. Verse 23, then he called two of the centurions and said, get ready 200 soldiers with 70 horsemen and 200 spearmen to go as far as Caesarea at the third hour of the night, which is 9 p.m. Also provide mounts for Paul to ride and bring him safely to Felix the governor. All right. So here he is the man of overkill. Okay. This guy, you know, Paul, we've got to get Paul from here to there. Let's do about almost 500 soldiers to get in there. How about that? You know, everything he does is over the top, trying to over control every situation so that he is not the one getting in trouble for any particular thing. So there he is trying to exert control and everything, but always feeling like he's on the edge of things falling apart in the way that he acts. And again, we see here's Paul, who cannot control where he is going next, but just calmly trusting God to do the next steps. You see this guy in power who has fallen apart. It reminds me of King Darius in Daniel 6. If you've not heard a lot of Bible studies, you've probably heard Daniel in the lion's den. So Daniel was a favorite of the king. King Darius loved Daniel, but some opponents of Daniel tricked the king into making a new law. They said to him, they said, King, you know what? There are people that pray to other gods, and that is something that is not showing loyalty to your greatness. Why don't you make a law that says it's illegal to pray to other gods, only to show my devotion to King Darius? And King Darius is like, oh, really? Okay, yeah, that sounds good. Well, let's do that. And they said, you know what? You need to bind that by the law of the Medes and the Persians, which is basically to say this is irrevocable. When this law is put in place, even the king who has dictated it cannot change it. So the king does that, like, great, I am a great king, boom, no one can pray to anybody else, the law's in place. So those guys lay in wait to watch Daniel pray, because Daniel meets the Lord regularly, and they know when he prays to go to God. And so when Daniel does that, they go in like, okay, arrest this guy. And the king is crushed, because he loves Daniel, and he's been tricked into this out of his own ego and of his own misunderstanding of the situation. And so Daniel is thrown to the lion's den, and it is amazing the difference between the reaction between Daniel and the king. Daniel's down there just chilling with the big cats, right? And the king, I love saying chilling with the big, I'm too old to say chilling with the big cats. All right, anyway. So Daniel's down there resting in God's provision for him with the lions, and the king has fallen apart. Daniel 18 of chapter 6 says, then the king went into his palace and spent the night fasting. No diversions were brought to him, and sleep fled from him. He had all authority, but no peace. He felt like he could control all these situations, but he was unraveling. And here is Daniel, who's like, all right, I just got thrown into this den of hungry cats. I will trust God and rest in that. And the difference between that stands out. And it's the same in the way that Paul responds versus the way the tribune responds. The contrast is palpable. So we take that story and move back into chapter 23, verse 23. And I call this section those poor... Oh, I'm sorry, I've already read that. That section we just read, verse 23, I call it those poor hangry guys. Because you realize now that their vow has been exposed as... over the top stupid, right? Because they have two choices, right? To either keep the vow or break the vow. If they keep the vow, they have two choices. It is either to get Paul to be dead somehow or to just continue to not eat, All right? So if they dishonor what they've sworn in front of these other Jewish leaders and they try and break the vow, that's not cool, right? So they got to keep the vow. They're going to die if they don't eat. But Paul is now surrounded by 500 soldiers to take him to the next place, and he's going to be put into Herod's Praetorium, which is a fort-like secure place for prisoners. So they've just sealed their death if they keep the vow. So again, you see the foolishness of what they did, and again, our worrisome tribune gets to work by mobilizing way more than enough soldiers. We're not going to read the rest of chapter 23. We'll go to chapter 24, but the rest of chapter 23 is the letter to Felix that the tribune writes, and Paul's transport by these soldiers, and then the move to Herod's Praetorium. Okay, so now chapter 24, verse 1, enter Tertullus. Tertullus will be a new name to us here, and we're not exactly sure who Tertullus is. He is representing the high priest and the Jewish leaders. And we don't know whether he was one of their group, whether he was a priest or a Jewish leader or a Pharisee or whatever, or whether he is a kind of paid attorney. And it's most people believe that he's more of the attorney voice of things here, that he's someone that knows his way around Roman law and is hired by these guys to be their mouthpiece. Because normally, if it's someone speaking for this group of Jewish leaders, it would be Ananias, the high priest. So here he steps in, and this is what we know about Tertullus. It says, after 5 days, the high priest Ananias came down with some elders and a spokesman, one Tertullus. They laid before the governor the case against Paul. All right? So that's where Tertullus comes in. Now, he's going to do a short speech that is 50% excessive flattery and 50% excessive flattery of Felix and 50% excessive inflammatory words about Paul. So you can see how that develops here. When he had been summoned, verse 2 says, Tertullus began to accuse him, saying, since through you we enjoy much peace, and since by your foresight, most excellent Felix, reforms are being made for this nation, in every way and in everywhere, we accept this with all gratitude. But to detain you no further, I beg in your kindness to hear us briefly. Okay, so he's buttered the guy up. Now he's going to do, again, the opposite side, very inflammatory words about Paul. He says, for we have found this man a plague. All right, you want to insult somebody, call them a plague, right? One who stirs up riots among all the Jews throughout the world and is a ringleader of the sect of the Nazarenes. He even tried to profane the temple, but we seized him. By examining him yourself, you'll be able to find out from him about everything of which we accuse him. All right. So again, these over-the-top, excessive words of how what a horrible person that Paul is a profaner. He is a ringleader of a sect. He is a plague. He stirs up riots. It's pretty clear in this brief thing that Paul needs to be someone that this guy decides against. All right. So this guy, being a guy of power, doesn't have to say, "Paul, it's your turn." He just nods. Right. Here we go. Verse 9. The Jews also joined the charge, affirming that all these things were so. And when the governor had nodded him to speak, Paul replied. So you know your power if you just go, and then someone knows that it's time to speak. But before we hear what Paul says, let's have an important reminder about how we need to view these last 8 chapters of Acts. All right, we are now in 24. Back in 21, it started that Paul is arrested. And we see something that happens the rest of the way out, that if we're not careful, we can get kind of lazy and dismissive about the last of the book of Acts. And to do that, we're going to have a teaching moment here. We are in an academic community, so we're going to business school, ladies and gentlemen. This is going to be great. All right, let me have a slide up here. We're going to learn some basic business, men and women. Now, you look at this graph, and what Jeff, my pastor, sees, Jeff is a University of Arkansas fan. So what Jeff sees, he sees the performance of University of Arkansas in the Belk Bowl against Virginia Tech. Here is halftime, right? And then it just whoosh. But Jeff, this is not University of Arkansas's performance in the Belk Bowl. This, my friends, is the product life cycle. And I have an MBA, so please be impressed. I'm going to stumble through this. You're like, why? How'd they ever give him a business degree? But anyway, I'll even read just to make this better and more professorial. Here we go. A new product progresses through a sequence of stages from introduction to growth, maturity, and decline. The sequence is known as the product life cycle and is associated with changes in the marketing situation, thus impacting the the marketing strategy and the marketing mix. All right, that's clear now what that is right now. Ross is marketing major. Is that good? Oh, thank you. I guess good. All right. So with this, any product goes through this kind of up and down thing. A couple examples that are just classic examples of things that you use every day, like the Rubik's Cube, right? The Rubik's Cube, right? When I was a kid, everybody had to have them. So the product is getting, I mean, people are into Rubik's Cube, and all of a sudden, all the kids have a Rubik's Cube. Nobody needs two Rubik's Cubes. So, boom, it sinks, it declines. They sell out to other companies who can make it cheaper and harvest that last little bit of nickel from their idea, right? Even though I think Rubik's Cubes are coming back. I keep seeing them in the stores. I don't know. But another one, Blockbuster Video, right? Okay, amazing idea. Back in the day, you wanted to see Die Hard 2, okay? You go to Blockbuster, and they got not only Die Hard 2, they got tons of other movies, big space. And when you go to the back of the new releases, if Die Hard 2 is out then, you know, it might have 30 to 50 copies of it. So you knew if you went to go to Blockbuster, you're probably getting a copy of the new release that you want. So, man, they took off. Blockbuster was a big deal. Technology changed a little bit somewhere in there. And I can't find Blockbuster anymore. I don't know. I'm looking. I can't find them. They're gone, right? The Blockbuster in Blacksburg is now a Verizon store, right? And so they disappeared. All right. So there is your beautiful lesson in business school stuff that I butchered. But that's how you get the general idea. Now, here's what we do. Or here's what I do, maybe you do. When I read the book of Acts, I start to get dismissive about the last part. I feel like Paul gets arrested and he just spends all this time going from leader to leader, telling his story, and he's in prison. He's not going from town to town encouraging these churches like he was and starting churches like crazy. This amazing flow in the book of Acts, somehow it's taken away from him in 21. And from verse 21 down, the book of Acts does this as Paul is just prison, heading to Rome. And then you don't really think that way, but sometimes I don't read the last chapters of Acts with a kind of hopefulness and belief in what God is doing through those pages. Because again, it's the same testimonies moving around in chains. But we know that what Paul says in the last part of this book, he has some of the most amazing things Paul says is in some of these testimonies to these leaders. Also, during this time period, Ephesians, Philippians, Colossians, 1 Timothy, 2 Timothy, Titus, Philemon, all those letters are written while Paul is imprisoned. The encouragement that Paul gives to other believers, the testimonies that he gives are crazy amazing. Where in my mind, when I read chapter 21, Paul arrested, and if you tell me at that point, he will not be released for the rest of this book. I would say, oh my goodness, wasted time coming up. This unbelievable catalyst in the growth of the early church is being locked up. God's done with him. The life cycle, product life cycle of Paul's youthfulness is starting to go downhill. But Paul didn't see that at all. Paul had a word from God that he knew what was going on, and he had seen God's faithfulness before. Each of the last couple of weeks, Jeff has emphasized this powerful verse right at the time of his arrest. And it is in chapter 23, verse 11. It's right after the time of his arrest. It says, the following night, the Lord stood by him. And say following night is right after he stood before this Jewish council. The following night, the Lord stood by him and said, take courage, for as you have testified to the facts about me in Jerusalem, so you must testify also in Rome. And God's saying, I am not done with you, though you will be in chains, double chains, thanks to the Tribune. Though you're in double chains, you are going to keep tasting my faithfulness. And you're going to keep being faithful to speak of the gospel of the resurrection. And you're going to continue to tell the world about me. And again, me and my little faith, I look and I'm tempted to say, this might be wasted years. These last part of the wasted years of Paul's life, if I'm not paying attention. And sometimes I do that with my own life, and I think, you know, if this situation was only better, then I could really serve God. This is a wasted time period because of that. But fortunately, I go to North Star, and at North Star, I'm surrounded by heroes that remind me of that no years are wasted years. And I have permission from a couple of those heroes to share some things I said to them. My friend Jamie leads the Gap group that meets in my house. Jamie, when she graduated from college, stepped right into her dream job of a middle school band teacher. Why that would be anyone's dream job, I do not know, but that was her dream job. And I'm sorry, she loved it. She loved it and was amazing at it. And then when her husband came here to do PhD work, she was not able to find work in that. So she's pieced together some different administrative things. And in that small group, I'm consistently hear her say, hey, will y'all pray for me in this? I'm not doing my favorite things, but there are people in my work that don't know Jesus. And there are days that my attitude is not right, and I want to make the most of what's happening there. And so she is a hero to me because she is not wasting her time. Though it'd be tempting to define these as the wasted years where she wasn't able to do her passion. She is stepping up every day saying, I am here, God has placed me here, God has a purpose for me, and I want to be faithful. And then my friend Ted. Ted constantly sharpens me. Ted was doing a job in this area that if I told you what the job was, you go, wow, that's impressive. All of a sudden, that job ended. Ted was released from that job. And Ted, he's with a group of guys that I meet with every Thursday morning for coffee. And to hear Ted's consistent thing of saying, man, God's got something. I'm trusting him. I'm walking through that. Instead of saying, wow, these circumstances are dictating such a thing that this time is miserable. Once I get past this, I can't wait till I have the resources and I have the position where I can influence people for Christ. But right now, these are wasted years because my plan is just in shambles. But Ted and Jamie and so many other people in this church are heroes to me because when they take things that are unexpected, they know that those aren't wasted times, that God is faithful and that God will carry them. You see, I am quite often tempted to do that, but these people don't do it. My circumstances don't waste my years. I waste my years. If I'm going to waste time and not serve God, that's a me decision. That's not a circumstance that's making me do it. I may say it's because of circumstances, but I've made that choice. Paul knew that Paul's circumstances were not going to waste his years. Only Paul could choose to waste his years. Your circumstances will not waste your years. If your years are wasted, you are choosing to waste your years because God is faithful and he can walk you through those circumstances. Even the most extreme tough things. I told you about those two examples. This one's a tough one, but my friend Melissa. Melissa was a former student and former staff member working with me. Melissa died 5 years ago of stomach and esophageal cancer. She died in early February of 2012. And the last time I had a great conversation visit with her was early January of 2012. And my friend Jeffrey and I went to visit her in the 757 Chesapeake. I'm sorry, I lost it for a second. I was 757 Chesapeake. There we go. So we're visiting with her in Chesapeake, and we're like, man, we want to go just encourage her because she knows that the end is near. She's gotten only bad news lately. And we went in there, and she lost all her hair from treatment, and she'd given up on wigs, and she was free in that. And she's like, and she just loved on us and welcomed us and affirmed and encouraged us. And she was not wasting that time, though she knew her days were limited. She was not going to let her circumstances say, oh, wasted time, horrible, this young life is ending early. She's like, no, man, I got these days to praise Jesus, and I got 10,000 more and more beyond that. And I'm going to make every day count because I know the power of the resurrection. Do not let your circumstances be an excuse where you waste your years. Your circumstances can't do that for you. You have to choose to do it. And in the same way, you've got to choose to look beyond those circumstances and say, man, God is still on the throne. And I'm not going to let those things define how I see my days because my God is in charge of my days. So in that, let's hear Paul's defense. Verses 10 through 16 of chapter 24. When the governor had nodded to speak, Paul replied, knowing that for many years, and this is Paul speaking now, knowing that for many years you've been a judge over this nation, I cheerfully make my defense. Okay, so Paul does his little bit of flattery, right? He said, you've done good stuff. Now I'm going to cheerfully make my defense. Yeah, here's chained up, just coming from prison. I'm cheerfully making my defense. You can verify that it is not more than 12 days since I went up to worship in Jerusalem, and they did not find me disputing with anyone or stirring up a crowd, either in the temple or in the synagogues or in the city. In other words, what he's saying is, I only got to Jerusalem 10 days ago, and they're saying that I did all this insurrection and stirring things up. Most of that time I've been in chains and walking through this, so I wasn't really around long enough to take things to the level they're accusing me of. Neither can they prove to you what they're now bringing up against me. But this I confess to you, according to the way, which they call a sect, and this is pretty cool because the way is mentioned three different chapters in Acts, and the first time it's when this guy named Saul gets permission to go kill followers of the way. And so here's Paul who said, yeah, I used to be the one, when I would say the way, it was a thing. Hey, can I kill those people? Can I arrest them and bring them to you or whatever, you know? And now he's like, no, I am part of the way because I now know the way and the truth and the life. And he says, I worship the God of our fathers, believing everything laid down by the law and written in the prophets, having a hope in God, which these men themselves accept, that there will be a resurrection of both the just and the unjust. So I always take pains to have a clear conscience toward both God and man. And you may miss the transition between 15 and 16 there. Why are you saying you always want to have a clear conscience? He's saying, because I believe there's a resurrection, I always want to have a clear conscience, right? Because if you believed, like some of his folks did in that day, that the end, and some people believe today, that the end of life is the end of it all. You either go to sleep or you stop existing or whatever. I can do whatever I want. Because then, I mean, there's nobody to keep me accountable at that point. But he's like, I know I'm built for eternity, that I'm going to live this life, and there's much better stuff coming later. But I want to have a clear conscience that I did this time right, and I treated people well, and that I did what God wanted me to do. So in that, he says, I take, because of what I believe about the resurrection, I take pains to have a clear conscience toward both God and man. And then He brings it back to resurrection again here in the latter part of 17 through 21. And he admits, a lot of scholars believe here he's admitting a mistake he made or a reactionary way that he acted in this. So let's read that. 17 through 21 says, now after several years, I came to bring alms to my nation and to present offerings. While I was doing this, they found me purified in the temple without any crowd or tumult. Again, he's saying, I didn't stir any of this up. But some Jews from Asia, they ought to be here before you and to make an accusation, should they have anything against me. And this is pretty cool. You see how intense he is. He says, these Jews from Asia, and he starts to tell what they did, and then he just stops and says, you know, they really should be here. And there's two things going on. He's like, he's saying how ridiculous it is, because under Roman law, if your accuser's not there, the case falls apart. So first of all, he's bringing that up. But again, he's so distracted by that, he's like, he doesn't even finish what he's going to say about them. He's telling the story of what happened, and he's about to say, these Jews from Asia, and then to tell that they were opposing him, but he's like, you know what? They're not here. They should be opposing me. Don't you think they should be testifying? Isn't this kind of a weird case there, Mr. Felix? You know. So he says, some Jews from Asia, they ought to be here. And then he's 20. He still gives it a shot for the case. He says, or let these other men themselves say what wrongdoing they found when I stood before the council. Other than this one thing, I cried out while standing among them, it is with respect to the resurrection of the dead that I'm on trial before you this day. He says, you know, he basically says, I'm blameless, well, except for this one thing. And he said it's about the resurrection, okay? And so to go back on what happened with that, let's go back to 23, verses 6 through 8. And I think Paul steps into the flesh for a minute here. The Spirit's been guided, but he's in the middle of this big tumult about him that these Jews from Asia have stirred the crowd up. And then he is gone. So then he's been arrested. And now he's before the Jewish council, and they're all stirred up. And says, verse 6 says, now when Paul perceived that one part were Sadducees and the other were Pharisees, he cried out in the councils, brothers, I'm a Pharisee, a son of a Pharisees. It is with respect to the hope and the resurrection of the dead that I am on trial. And when he had said this, a dissension rose between the Pharisees and Sadducees, and the assembly was divided. For the Sadducees say that there's no resurrection, nor angel, nor spirit, but the Pharisees acknowledge them all. All right, now so you see there's these two groups that they were unified in their hating Paul, and the Venn diagram of what they believed overlapped a lot. But the one thing that they were definitely apart on is Pharisees believed that there was a resurrection from the dead, that there is this life, and then there is eternity, and in eternity you will have existence, either with God or without God, okay? And the Sadducees said, no, that's it. Dirt nap when it's done. You are asleep, you cease existing, your soul doesn't, you know, and that's what they firmly believe. So Paul, in the middle of this assembly of all these Jews, he yells this thing out, which probably shows it wasn't a good idea. And he says, hey, you know, it's about this resurrection from the dead. And so he yells that out to try and divide them, okay? And now in this, I think scholars say that he kind of owned this here, but at the end of it, he's like, you know, what I kind of did irresponsibly, God intends for good, because if I'm on trial for the resurrection, let me be on trial, because I am about the resurrection. And Paul embraces that. So he does say, if I'm on trial, he says, you know, maybe I did make one mistake in yelling this thing out about the resurrection, but he owns it, and he ends with that. And it's like, this is about the resurrection. And he's right in diving in with that. And so here we are a week after Easter, but we don't want to focus on the fact that, okay, that was resurrection week. Resurrection is for every week, every day, every moment. We rest in the power of the resurrection. That was Paul's life. That was Paul's message. That's the way he did everything. And so that's what he said. He modifies what he said before and said, you know, hey, that was about the resurrection, but you know what? Yes, it is with respect to the resurrection of the dead that I'm on trial before you this day, and I'll own that because that's what I'm basing my life on. And in that, you know, the power of the resurrection is still at the core of what matters most, whether it's Easter or not. And whether you're wherever you are in life, a great way to make sure that you're not in a time that you're making that wasted years, the resurrection's a great thing to focus on. The gospel, the good news of new life in Christ. What a cool Sunday to talk about this after seeing Fadi's testimony and baptism. Because every time someone is baptized, they are preaching a sermon that you are dead to the old ways and raised to walk in newness of life in Christ. And Fadi declared that. He's declared it to his parents with much courage and the beauty of him stepping forward and saying, no one else is going to make my choices about my life. I'm not going to waste my life. It's going to stand for Jesus. And I believe in the power of resurrection. And I want baptism to show that and be one place where I preach that sermon in my life. So that power of the resurrection that Paul kind of gave as a last word, and then he stepped back. That was his mic drop, if you will. He's like, you know, yeah, maybe I messed up here in the area of the resurrection, but you know what? I'll stand on trial for that because I want to be convicted of believing in the resurrection of Jesus Christ, which in turn secures the resurrection of my life to walk with a loving Father forever. So that's where we see Paul walk. And again, if you're tempted to say, oh, maybe these last years were wasted years for Paul, as you read, you know, chapter 21, chapter 22, chapter 23, chapter 24, chapter 25, chapter 26, chapter 27, chapter 28, all that time he's in prison, and you're tempted to go, what a waste. And God's going, no. I want to blow up some things in the church because of this and make it grow even more. I'm going to give the church long haul truth that he's going to write while he's there in prison. I'm going to give Timothy encouragement of what he's going to write there from prison. I'm going to change people's lives because my servant Paul knows that circumstances aren't going to waste his life in years. He's going to choose to rest in the truth I've given him about me, the truth of the resurrection. So are we ready to rest in that today? One of Paul's letters, he made an amazing statement about the resurrection, which I absolutely love. North Star does many things well. One thing we do well is awkward silence. So what I want us to do in a minute, I'm going to read Philippians 3, 8 through 11. And then after a moment, after I read it, I'm going to leave it up here and we'll be quiet for about a minute, minute and a half or so for you to read that, maybe jot something in your journal about what it looks like for you to live in the resurrection this week and to put circumstances aside and to focus on that truth of what he has done for you in that. And then after that time of silence, I'll pray for it. So I'm going to read us the verses. Then you can continue to read it, maybe jot some in the journal or pray through this verse or whatever. And then I'll pray for us. And after I pray, the band will come up and lead us in another song of worship. Philippians 3, 8 through 11 says, indeed, I count everything as loss because of the surpassing worth of knowing Christ Jesus my Lord. For his sake, I've suffered the loss of all things and count them as rubbish, in order that I may gain Christ and be found in him, not having a righteousness of my own that comes from the law, but that which comes through faith in Christ, the righteousness from God that depends on faith, that I may know him and the power of his resurrection and may share in his sufferings, becoming like him in his death, that by any means possible I may attain the resurrection from the dead. Soak in that truth for the next minute or so and just pray to him where you are.